Chapter 2. The owner of the small general store at Orion Lake, 90 miles due west of Seattle, turned slightly and peered at the man who opened the door and stood momentarily on the threshold. Orion Lake was off the beaten track to most traffic, and Dick Colburn knew everyone in this rugged area of the Olympic Peninsula Mountains. The stranger was either a tourist passing through or a fisherman from the city, trying his luck with either the salmon or trout stocked in the nearby lake by the Forest Service. He wore a short leather jacket over an Irish knit sweater and corduroy pants. No hat covered a mass of wavy black hair that was streaked gray at the temples. Colburn watched as the stranger stared unblinkingly at the shelves and display cases before stepping inside. Out of habit, Colburn studied the man for a few moments. The stranger was tall. His head cleared the top of the door by less than 3 fingers. Not the face of an office worker, Colburn decided. The skin was too tan and craggy for a life spent indoors. The cheeks and chin were in need of a shave. The body seemed thin for the frame. There was the unmistakable look about him of a man who had seen too much, who had suffered hardship and grief. He appeared tired, not physically tired, but emotionally used up, someone who cared little about life anymore. It was almost as if he had been tapped on the shoulder by death, but had somehow shrugged him off. Yet there was a quiet cheerfulness in the opaline green eyes that broke through the haggard features, and an obscure sense of pride. Colburn concealed his interest well, and went about his business of stocking the shelves. "Can I help you with anything?" he asked over his shoulder. "Just dropped by to pick up a few groceries," replied the stranger. Colburn's store was too small for shopping carts, so he picked up a basket, slinging the carrying handles over one arm. "How's the fishing?" "Haven't tried my luck yet." "There's a good hole at the south end of the lake where they've been known to bite." "I'll keep that in mind. Thank you." "Got you a fishing license yet?" "No, but I'll bet you're authorized to sell me one." "Resident or non-resident of the state of Washington?"
"None."
The grocer pulled out a form from beneath the counter and handed the stranger a pen. "Just fill in the applicable blanks. I'll add the fee onto your groceries." To Colburn's practiced ear, the accent was vaguely southwestern. "The eggs are fresh, laid right here in town. There's a sale on cans of Seamus O'Malley stew, and the smoked salmon and the elk steaks taste like they came from heaven." For the first time, a hint of a smile crossed the stranger's lips. "The elk steaks and the salmon sound good, but I think I'll pass on Mr. O'Malley's stew." After nearly 15 minutes, the basket was full and set on the counter beside an antique brass cash register. Instead of the usual selection of canned goods picked by most fishermen, this basket was filled with mostly fruits and vegetables. "You must be planning on staying a while," said Colburn. "An old family friend loaned me his cabin on the lake. You probably know him. His name is Sam Foley."
"I've known Sam for 20 years. His cabin is the only one that damn Chinaman hasn't bought up," Colburn grumbled. "Good thing, too. If Sam sells out, there won't be an access for fishermen to launch their boats on the lake."
I wondered why most of the cabins looked run down and abandoned, all except that odd-looking building. The one on the north side of the lake opposite the mouth of that small river flowing west. Colburn spoke as he rang up the groceries.
"Used to be a fish cannery back in the 40s, until the company went broke. The Chinaman picked it up for a song and then remodeled it into a fancy mansion. Even built a 9-hole golf course. Then he began buying every piece of property that fronted on the lake. Your friend, Sam Foley, is the only holdout.
It seems half the population of Washington and British Columbia is Chinese, commented the stranger. The Chinese have poured into the Pacific Northwest like a flood tide since the communist government took over Hong Kong. They already own half of downtown Seattle and most of Vancouver. No telling what the population will look like in another 50 years. Colburn paused and punched the total lever on the cash register. With the fishing permit, that'll be $79.35. The stranger pulled his wallet from a hip pocket, handed Colburn a $100 bill, and waited for the change. The Chinaman you mentioned, what sort of business is he in? All I heard is that he's a wealthy shipping tycoon from Hong Kong. Colburn began sacking the groceries while gossiping away. Nobody has ever seen him. Never comes through town. Except for drivers of big delivery trucks, nobody goes in or out. Strange goings-on, if you ask most of the folks around here. He and his cronies don't fish in the daytime. You can only hear boat motors at night, and they don't run lights. Harry Daniels, who hunts and camps along the river, claims he's seen an odd-looking workboat traveling the lake after midnight, and never under a moon. Everybody loves a good mystery. If I can do anything for you while you're in the neighborhood, just ask. My name's Dick Colburn. The stranger showed white, even teeth and a broad grin. Dirk Pitt. You be from California, Mr. Pitt? You do Professor Henry Higgins proud, said Pitt lightheartedly. I was born and grew up in Southern California, but for the past 15 years I've lived in Washington. Colburn began to smell new ground. You must work with the U.S. government. The National Underwater and Marine Agency. And before you misreckon, I came to Orion Lake strictly to relax and unwind. Nothing more. If you'll pardon me for saying so, said Colburn sympathetically, you look like a man who could use some rest. Pitt grinned. What I really need is a good back rub. Cindy Elder. She tends bar over at the Sockeye Saloon and gives a great massage. I'll keep her in mind. Pitt took the grocery sacks in both arms and headed for the door. Just before stepping outside, he stopped and turned. Out of curiosity, Mr. Colburn, what is the Chinaman's name? Colburn looked at Pitt, trying to read something in the eyes that wasn't there. He calls himself Chang, Chin Chang. Did he ever say why he purchased the old canning factory? Norman Selby, the real estate agent who handled the transaction, said Chang wanted a secluded area on water to build a fancy retreat where he could entertain affluent clients. Colburn paused and looked positively belligerent. You must have seen what he did to a perfectly good cannery. Only a matter of time before the State Historical Commission would have named it as a historic site. Chang turned it into a cross between a modern office building and a pagoda. An abortion, I say, a damned abortion. It does have a novel look about it, Pitt agreed. No doubt Chang, as a neighborly gesture, invites the town citizens to parties and golf tournaments. Are you kidding? Said Colburn, venting his anger. Chang won't even allow the mayor and city council within a mile of his property. Would you believe he even erected a 10-foot chain-link fence with barbed wire on the top around most of the lake? Can he get away with that? He can and did, by buying off politicians. He can't keep people off the lake. It belongs to the state. But he can make it hard for them to get on. Some people have a fetish for privacy, said Pitt. Chang's got more than a fetish. Security cameras and armed goons crawl through the woods all around the place. Hunters and fishermen who accidentally wander too close are hustled off the land and treated like common criminals. I must remember to stay on my side of the lake. Probably wouldn't be a bad idea. See you in a few days, Mr. Colburn. Come again, Mr. Pitt.
Have a nice day.
Pitt looked up at the sky. Not much of the day was left. The late afternoon sun was partially shaded by the tops of the fir trees rising behind Colburn's store. He set the grocery bags on the rear passenger seat of his rental car and climbed behind the wheel. He turned the ignition key, shifted into drive, and pressed the accelerator. 5 minutes later, he turned off the asphalt highway onto a dirt road leading to the Foley cabin on Orion Lake. For 2 miles, the road meandered through a forest of cedar, spruce, and hemlock. At the end of a quarter-mile straight, he came to a fork, each road skirting the shore of the lake in opposite directions until meeting up again on the far side, which happened to be Chin Shang's extravagant retreat. Pitt could not help but agree with the grocer's description. The former cannery had truly been transformed into an architectural miscarriage, totally inappropriate for a beautiful setting on an alpine lake. It was as though the builder had begun a modern structure of copper-tinted solar glass intermingled with exposed steel beams, then changed his mind and turned it over to a 15th-century Ming Dynasty contractor who topped the building with a golden tile roof straight off the majestic Hall of Supreme Harmony in the Forbidden City at Beijing. After being told that the owner was cloistered by an elaborate security system, Pitt, while enjoying the solitude of the lake, now assumed his movements were being observed. He turned onto the road bearing left and continued for another half mile before stopping beside a wooden stairway leading to a porch that ran around an attractive log cabin overlooking the lake. He remained sitting in the car for a minute, gazing at a pair of deer that were feeding in the woods. The soreness had gone out of his injuries, and he could exercise movement almost as well as he could before the tragedy. The cuts and burns had for the most part healed. It was his mind and emotions that were taking longer. He was 10 pounds lighter and not making a concerted effort at putting the lost weight back on. He felt as if he had lost all sense of purpose. It was a case of actually feeling worse than he looked. But deep down there was a spark that was fanned by an inherent urge to peer into the unknown. The spark burst into flame soon after he carried the groceries inside the cabin and set them on the kitchen sink. Something did not seem right. He couldn't put his finger on it, but it quietly gnawed at his mind, some unfathomable sixth sense that told him something was wrong. He stepped into the living room. Nothing out of the ordinary there. He cautiously entered the bedroom, glanced around, checked the closet, and moved into the bathroom. And then he had it. The toiletry items from his shaving kit, razor, cologne, toothbrush, hairbrush, were always placed in neat order on the sink after he arrived at his destination. They were right where he had set them, all except the shaving kit itself. He distinctly recalled holding it by the outside strap and pushing it onto a shelf. Now the strap was facing the rear wall. He went through the rooms now, carefully studying every loose object. Somebody, probably more than one person, had been over every inch of the cabin. They had to be professionals, but became indifferent when they concluded that the resident was not a secret agent or a hired assassin, but merely a guest of the cabin's owner, enjoying a few peaceful days of relaxation. From the time Pitt left for town until he returned, they had a good 45 minutes to do the job. At first the reason behind the search escaped Pitt, but then a light began to glow in the dim reaches of his brain. There had to be something else. To an expert spy or gold badge detective, the answer would be immediately transparent. But Pitt was neither. A former Air Force pilot and longtime special projects director for NUMA, His specialty was troubleshooting the agency's underwater projects, not undercover investigation. It took him a good 60 seconds to solve the dilemma. He realized that the search was secondary. The real purpose was to install listening devices or miniature cameras. "Someone doesn't trust me," Pitt thought. And that someone must be the chief of Qin Shang's security network. Because listening bugs were no larger than pinheads, they would be difficult to find without an electronic snooping device. But since Pitt had only himself to talk to, he decided to concentrate on the cameras. Assuming he was under surveillance and his every movement was being observed by someone sitting in front of a TV monitor on the other side of the lake, he sat down and pretended to read a newspaper while his mind churned. Let them see what they want in the living room and bedroom, he reasoned. The kitchen was another matter. That would be his war room. He put down the paper and began putting away the groceries in the cupboards and refrigerator, using the activity as a distraction while his eyes darted into every nook and cranny. He found nothing conspicuous. Then he began casually glancing at the log walls of the cabin, peering into the cracks and chinking. He finally hit pay dirt when he spotted a tiny lens pressed into a wormhole, burrowed when the log was the trunk of a growing tree. Playing the role of an actor in front of a camera, which indeed he was, Pitt swept the floor with a broom. When he was finished, he turned the broom upside down and leaned the sweeper part against the wall directly in front of the camera. As if given a shot to spur his adrenaline, he brushed off any feelings of fatigue and tension and stepped outside, walking 30 paces away from the cabin into the woods. He pulled a Motorola Iridium phone from the inside pocket of his jacket. After dialing a number, his signal was bounced over a network of 66 satellites around the world and down to the private line of the person he was calling at the NUMA headquarters in Washington, D.C. After four rings, a voice with a slight New England twang answered. "This is Hiram Yeager. Be brief. Time is money." "Your time isn't worth a dime stuck in gum on the bottom of a shoe." "Am I the subject of mockery by NUMA's Special Projects Director?"
"You are."
"What are you doing that's not worth repeating?" asked Yeager facetiously. Yet his voice betrayed a trace of concern. He knew Pitt was still recovering from injuries suffered during a volcanic eruption on an island off Australia only the month before. "I haven't time to leave you breathless with my daring adventures in the North Woods. But I do need a favor. I'm drooling with anticipation. See what you can dig up on a Qin Shang." "How's it spelled?" "Probably like it sounds. If my limited knowledge of Chinese menus serves me correctly, the first name begins with a Q. Shang is a Chinese shipping magnate who operates out of Hong Kong. He also owns a private retreat on Orion Lake in Washington State."
"Is that where you're at?" asked Yeager.
"You never told anyone where you were going when you up and disappeared."
"I'd just as soon Admiral Sandecker was kept in the dark."
"He'll find out anyway. He always does. Just what is it that intrigues you about Shang?"
"You might say I'm irritated by nosy neighbors," replied Pitt.
"Why don't you go over and borrow a cup of sugar, have a few laughs, and challenge him to a fast game of mahjong? According to the locals, no one can get within 10 city blocks of his place. And at that, I doubt if he's at home. If Shang is like most wealthy celebrities, he has several different houses around the world." "Why does this guy consume you with curiosity?"
"No upstanding citizen has a mania about security unless he has something to hide," said Pitt.
"Sounds to me like you're bored, lying around the primeval forest watching moss grow on the rocks. You've missed one of life's pleasures if you haven't tried to outstare a moose for 45 minutes. "I've never been turned on by apathy." "Any other requests?"
while I'm in the mood?" asked Jaeger. "Now that you mention it, I do have a wish list of Christmas goodies I'd like boxed and sent out tonight so I can have them no later than tomorrow afternoon." "Fire away," said Jaeger. "I've turned on the recorder and will print them out when you're finished." Print described the articles and equipment he required. When he finished, he added, "Throw in a Department of Natural Resources chart of Orion Lake showing bathymetric data and fish species, underwater wrecks and obstructions." The plot thickens. "For a guy who was battered to a pulp and just released from a hospital, don't you think you're overdoing it?" "Play along with me and I'll mail you 5 pounds of smoked salmon." "I hate being a weenie," Jaeger sighed. "Okay, I'll take care of your toys before I make inquiries through proper and improper channels on Xin Shang. With luck, I'll give you his blood type." Pitt knew from experience that data buried and secreted in classified files was not immune to Jaeger's ferret-like talents. "Set those fat little fingers flying over your keyboard and call me at my Iridium number when you turn up something." Jaeger hung up the phone, leaned back in his chair, and stared thoughtfully at the ceiling for several moments. Jaeger looked more like a street-corner panhandler than he did a brilliant computer systems analyst. He kept his graying hair in a ponytail and dressed like an aging hippie, which he was. Jaeger was head of NUMA's computer data network, which contained a vast library on every book, article, and thesis, whether scientific, historical fact, or theory, ever recorded on the world's oceans. Jaeger's computer domain took up the entire 10th floor of the NUMA building. It had taken years to put together the massive library. His boss had given him a free hand and unlimited funding for accumulating every recorded bit of knowledge on ocean science and technology so it could be available to ocean science students, professional oceanographers, marine engineers, and underwater archaeologists around the world. The job carried enormous responsibility, but it was a job Jaeger loved with a passion. He turned his gaze on the expansive computer he had designed and built himself. Fat fingers on a keyboard, ha! There was no keyboard and no monitor. As with virtual reality, images were projected in 3 dimensions in front of the user. Instead of typing on keys, commands were spoken. A caricature of Jaeger, enhanced and fleshed out, stared back at him. "Well, Max, you ready to go cruising?" Jaeger asked the image. "I am Prime," replied a disembodied voice. "Acquire all available information on a Qin Shang, a Chinese shipping company owner whose main office is in Hong Kong. Data insufficient for a detailed report," said Max in a monotone. "Not much to go on, I admit," said Jaeger, never quite getting the hang of talking to a nebulous image produced by a machine. "Do the best you can. Print out your findings when you've exhausted all the networks." "I will get back to you shortly," droned Max. Jaeger stared at the space vacated by his holographic likeness, his eyes narrow and questioning. Pitt had never asked him to research and build a file unless he had good reason. Something Jaeger knew was running around in his friend's head. Quandaries and enigmas followed Pitt around like puppy dogs. He was drawn to trouble like salmon to their spawning grounds. Jaeger hoped Pitt would reveal the mystery. He always did. He always had to when his projects went beyond the mere realm of casual interest. "What in hell is the crazy bastard up to this time?" Jaeger muttered to his computer.